Well, it seems to be just us. I'm going to assume that you know your panel, so I will not introduce the panel again. And I understand y'all are ready, so we'll get started. Welcome to the 3 o'clock docket that's starting at 3:25. The civil cases just went longer because we asked too many questions. I asked too many questions. Okay.
The court will now call Edward Earl Washington III versus the state of Texas. May it please the court. Ms. Lisa Mullen will argue for the appellant. Mr. Edward Wilkinson will argue for the applicant of the state.
Okay, Lisa.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, obviously I'm here on behalf of Mr. Washington on this appeal, which I think, but maybe I'm biased, is a little more interesting than the civil case I just heard. However, I'll start with the first ground, which is a sufficiency of the evidence, and it dovetails very easily and nicely with the sudden passion, which is the third point of error I raised, the lack of giving that jury charge. So I'm going to kind of combine them as I speak with leave of the court to do so. Basically, this factual scenario is ridiculous that somebody loses their life over a Super Bowl bet, but that's basically how this all began. My client did not kill anybody, and that's uncontroverted from the evidence. He was wholly and completely charged as a party under the conspiracy theory of parties, as well as the straight theory of parties, aiding and abetting. But it is uncontroverted from the facts that he ever had the gun, shot the gun, or caused the death of the victim in this case. However, my client, Trey is what they called him, it's Edward Washington formally, had a bet with the victim over the Super Bowl that had occurred months earlier. Apparently, the victim was not going to pay off on the bet, so there was some mad dogging back and forth, talking back and forth, texting back and forth over a period of time, finally coming to fruition on this particular date, I'm guessing occurring because the victim, who was in a rap band, was playing, and they all ended up in the same place over in Arlington at the concert. So it kind of got things spiked off again. My client and CJ is the co-defendant, and I'll just refer to him as that. He is actually the person that killed the victim in this case. Are at the concert, there's some jawing that occurs there, but afterwards is where it really starts to heat up. Finally, the victim says, look, just meet me at this gas station, let's have a fist fight. Whoever gets knocked down is squashed. This whole argument about this Super Bowl bet's over. And so things start to unravel from there. The victim and his girlfriend and two other individuals then travel to the gas station where he's decided he's going to meet, so they're going to fight it out. My client, as well as CJ, the actual killer, the co-defendant, and the girlfriend go also. There's some discussion. They park in the back. The victim pulls up to the front, gets my guy to come around to the front, parks the cars, and at that point, things really unravel because the evidence reflects as they pull up, they park in front of the victim's car, my client is driving, and CJ, or co-defendant, immediately gets out of the car, goes over to where the victim is, opens the car door, reaches through, grabs the victim, and is pulling him out of the car. A fight ensues. They start to fight. There's a little divergence in the testimony. It conflicts to some extent as far as exactly what happened. But Mr. Trigg is a friend of the victim, and he was the one that was closest in on exactly what happens from that point. Co-defendants pulls the victim out, they start fighting, and it's just a fist fight. They are gonna squash this or whatever they're gonna do, they're having a fist fight. At that point, the two other people with the victim get out of the car, and they're all attacking CJ. So it's a 3-on-1 at that point. Mr. Trigg, in his testimony, who is like a brother to the victim, so he would apparently have no motive to lie, was telling the story just as it happened, states very specifically and very clearly in his testimony that he then starts beating CJ over the head. He said it was about the fourth hit, and that's when CJ, or the co-defendant, comes out with the gun. At that point, the victim and CJ begin tussling over the gun, and as Mr. Trigg says, the gun just goes off. And that's where we have a sufficiency issue concerning the party's charge holding my client responsible for murder under any theory, conspiracy or straight up.
But what about transferred intent? Can you apply transferred intent to a party?
I don't believe so, not in these factual scenarios. I don't think so at all. I don't think there was any transfer intent. I think the gun accidentally went off. I don't think there was an intent to kill.
No, but if you have an intent to commit the felony of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, which pulling a gun, it's aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, well, if...
I see where you're going with that, but the way this case was charged to the jury, there was still an intent to shoot him with the gun.
Okay.
And that's the allegation in the charging paragraphs. It's kind of a convoluted charge. It's difficult because there wasn't an engaging in an organized crime count, count one, and the second count was murder. Jury found not guilty of engaging, so I'm moving that out. What's also interesting is they dovetailed, which I would have argued against, but I wasn't the trial counsel, they dovetailed that engaging into the conspiracy theory of parties on the murder charge. I think that has to be excluded now because it couldn't be a conspiracy to commit engaging in organized crime. The jury's already thrown that out. So the only thing they're left with is basically four ways to commit this murder that my client would be an accomplice to. One is straight up intentionally or knowingly causing the death by shooting him with a firearm, the conduct of CJ, and my guy aided and abetted in that in any regard. There's no evidence in the record whatsoever that my client aided in any regard concerning the gun, concerning the conduct that occurred on the scene that night. The witnesses testified that my client was not involved with the struggle over the gun. He never said, shoot him, pull your gun, go for it, anything of that nature. And there's no evidence, not even a modicum in this particular factual scenario, concerning an intent to kill, that CJ wanted to intentionally or knowingly cause the death of the victim. And I think Mr. Trigg's testimony, the victim's friend's testimony, specifically says so. I mean, he just felt like they were wrestling over it and the gun went off and he testified to that. Any other intent is pure speculation. It is my belief and my argument in this case. The second way they try to get there is, like you were saying, with an intent, they have to prove that CJ or the co-defendant had an intent to cause serious bodily injury, did an act clearly dangerous to human life that resulted in the death. But in this case, the charging paragraph says, to wit, by shooting him with a deadly weapon. They fail there because I think, once again, based on the evidence in this case, it's insufficient to prove an intent on CJ's part to shoot him with a deadly weapon.
Is it inferred from pulling the gun?
I don't think so, because I think that's an act of self-defense, a sudden passion defense that I talk about in my third point, based on these facts. And every factual scenario we always know are very different. But if when you specifically read the testimony of the parties involved in this particular case, there's just no evidence that he intended to shoot him with the gun. And you have to believe, to find the evidence sufficient, that he intended to cause serious bodily injury by shooting him with the gun, as it is alleged in this case, in this jury charge that I've attached to my document. The third way that they would get there is on the conspiracy theories, and that is with the intent to commit, they were entered into a conspiracy to commit the offense of aggravated assault. I've thrown out the organized crime part because I don't think the jury's basically found not guilty of that. But once again, it's even worse in the way that's charged in this particular jury charge because it builds in the language with the intent to shoot him, intentionally shoot him with a firearm. You can read the charging paragraphs on the conspiracy theory of parties. I think either way, the evidence is insufficient to show intentionally shooting him with a firearm on CJ's part, and then my client is...
I want to ask you about one statement that's
yes,
on page 29 of the state's brief.
Okay.
Sorry, I beg your pardon.
29, page 29 of the state's brief. It says the appellant was able to strike Thomas at least once with a plank before Boston grabbed him by the shirt and pulled him away just as he raised the plank for a second blow. Brown. We're talking about CJ here. You're calling him CJ. His last name's Brown.
Yes, Your Honor.
Brown, lying on top of Thomas, gained a little bit of leverage over him and fired the pistol. isn't that direct evidence of an intentional act on the use of the pistol to fire a shot at Thomas?
I don't believe so if you combine this with the rest of the testimony of the witness, Your Honor. I think that's, in my humble opinion, I think that's a little bit out of context as far as the full context of the testimony of the witness. And it's conflicting with another witness, and that being Mr. Triggs' testimony.
Afterwards, did he point the state says he pointed the gun at Thomas after he got up.
Yes, there is one witness that does testify that after the shot went off, he stands up and points the gun again, and the girlfriend grabs him and says, let's go, don't do it, don't do it. And they all get in the car and leave. But my further argument regarding all of that is that inferring that intent to my client, that it's so minimal, and the fact that the victim's own friend had the full impression that the gun just went off during the struggle, that's insufficient in and of itself. But then you step one step away to my client has to have that intent as well, a desire to want that to happen, even when the actual actor's intent is minimal, a modicum of evidence, doesn't even meet that standard.
How are you in your presentation treating all these emails?
Text messages?
Yes, ma'am, the text messages that were exchanged and that seem to be a rather constant expression of the intent on the part of your client that he was going to shoot Mr. Thomas.
Yes, Your Honor, and it's probably the worst part of the case as far as my client goes and his bad conduct involved in this entire process. And the way I address it, the way I believe is appropriate given the facts of the case, is initially he made threats much prior to these events, right after the debt wasn't paid. I don't think that accrues to this. Then following it, those are probably the most damaging. I think it's just talking out the side of his mouth. He's just jabber-jawing. He's trying to sound bad. He's trying to make himself sound good by sounding bad. Obviously, it's ridiculously stupid. But furthermore, it's clear that he's bragging, and it's braggadocio, because he's saying, I shot him. I just, quote, murked somebody, which is another word for murder. Left him on the side of the road. He's taking full responsibility, and we know actually, factually, that he did not kill anybody. It was not his conduct. He was not telling anybody to kill anybody. None of the witnesses state that he was. And so I don't think that accrues to the intent at the moment that the situation occurred. I think the aftermath is somebody trying to sound bad, and he accomplishes it, but on our standards for a much different reason. But that's the only way I can address those comments after the fact.
Okay, but the fact is that these comments made on the text were presented to the jury for them to decide in terms of when they were asked the questions that were presented in the state's charge.
That's correct.
And this statement, this JT, he owed me money, comma, left him dead on the curb.
Correct.
That's one of the statements, but that's not, there's a whole series of them, like you said.
Correct.
I mean, those are things that went to the jury in trying to assess whether or not Mr. Washington was a active participant.
That's correct.
In the circumstances that caused the direct murder charge to be filed against Mr. Brown.
And I totally agree with that. However, I think that specific argument is exactly what shows how a jury could reach a decision on legally insufficient evidence, an unreasonable decision, because those are so prejudicial.
I wasn't trying to argue. I was just from the state's brief.
No, I love it. No, that's exactly what I want to talk about, because it is the worst piece of evidence. But I also think it is very it gives us evidence of why a jury would hate Mr. Washington, be prejudicial against Mr. Washington. And I don't think that accrues to the specific intent of CJ. That's not the co-defendant's statements. And it's a lie, so we know it's bragging. And we also know at the scene he wasn't telling him to kill him. He wasn't trying to get him to kill him. He wasn't participating. So I don't think his statements after the fact, even moments after the fact, trying to brag, proves an intent when we have an accidental discharge of a firearm from the actual actor. I'm almost out of time, but one issue I did want to address is the jury note, because I think that's really an interesting issue. The jury basically sends out the note that I've attached that says that they are clearly misunderstanding the law, which to me that's the most interesting part of it. They say in the charge or in the law there's a statement that says, to wit, a firearm. And they basically say, are indicating that they think that that could mean either it has to specifically be a firearm, or it's exemplary, it could be a firearm or anything else, other stuff that are.
Oh, that to wit means, for example?
Right. That's what they indicate in their note. That is clearly a jury that is misunderstanding the law. And to me, a judge has, and based on the case law, a court has an absolute duty for one thing and one thing that is of imperative importance as a judge in the case.
Go ahead.
30 seconds. And that is to make sure the jury clearly understands the law. The judge has to clarify that because they misunderstand. And the judge refused to respond. He just said refer back to the jury charge over strenuous objections by the defense attorney saying, look, this jury has got to know that that has only means firearm.
But they didn't find a fire. There was no deadly weapon finding, right?
Right. They found no on the deadly weapon, but in the note they referred to it as the law in general, and firearm is used in every application paragraph in this jury charge. So my argument that doesn't negate the harm as argued by the state in their brief, because firearm is specifically a firearm. And if you read their note, they're saying it in general. Can't remember the exact words they use. So I think that accrues to the entire use of firearm in this case, and they clearly were confused as to the law. The judge had a due process duty to clarify that.
So you're saying to wit a firearm to the jury could mean either a firearm or a piece of wood with nails sticking out of it?
Correct, and particularly given there was testimony regarding a board, I think that's really why they were asking that question, because there was one witness that said my client had a board. There was the other witness said that they didn't see him with a board, but there was an argument that he had a board, and the state argued it in their closing arguments as far as his intent went, Mr. Washington's intent. And I think that's what they were wondering, particularly since he wasn't the hands-on person. He was only charged as a party in the case. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thanks, Lisa. Chip.
May it please the court. I'm a little out of sorts as to where to start. The state's disputes both her position on the law and on the facts. I'll start very briefly with the law. She said that this court should simply dispense with an analysis of the sufficiency of the evidence as to those paragraphs in the charge that address the 702B issue, the conspiracy to commit ag assault
where's the evidence of the agreement?
I beg your pardon?
Where's the evidence of an agreement? And if so, that dump you into the conspiracy statute?
She said that since the jury found him not guilty on the first count, that you should immediately discount all those in those paragraphs that address the organized criminal activity as well. But the law is very clear that the courts allow inconsistent verdicts in a jury charge. And simply because they're inconsistent doesn't mean that you don't analyze them for the sufficiency of the evidence. Even though they are inconsistent, if there's evidence to support the any or all of the paragraphs, then this court must go ahead and do the legal sufficiency analysis as to those paragraphs.
Let me ask you this, Chip.
As to the intent, the state would maintain that the defense is confining their analysis of whether there's sufficient evidence for intent only to the actual fight itself. And the state would maintain that, no, the proper way to analyze the intent is to look at far more evidence than that. The comments, statements, any acts that may have occurred before the actual fight, and any comments or acts that have occurred actually after the fight as well. That would include the text messages. That would include their... I beg your pardon.
Okay. During the fight, participating in the fight, going to get a weapon, the board with, I'm impressed by the board with the nails, during the fight, going to get a weapon, participating in the fight, isn't that indication of acting as a party to the other person in the fight?
Yes, Your Honor, the state would maintain that Brown, by participating in the fight, and indeed starting it, leaps out of the car and pulls the victim out of the car before appellant can even get there. And I would also point out one of the facts that we dispute is that Trigg specifically testified that at one point, three assailants, appellant, CJ, and a third unidentified party, were all beating the victim before Trigg got involved in the fight. So far from being a three-on-one on poor little CJ, it was a three-on-one on the victim before the victim's friends could intervene to act in defense of a third party, which is why the state maintains he wasn't entitled to a charge on sudden passion. To go back to your question, yes, if you consider all the acts, the fact that he participated, agreed to participate in an obviously arranged I want to say they jumped him. They brought the car in. They obviously had it planned as to what they do. They obviously had planned who they were going to go after. All three of them descended on the victim before the victim's friends could intervene. They brought weapons to what should have been a fist fight. Appellant vowed to kill the victim, not only to third parties, but to the victim himself. Brown was known to that both were members of a violent street gang that was known to retaliate against people they had believed had disrespected them.
Which one?
I beg your pardon?
Which street gang?
Lynch mob.
Okay.
Lynch mob.
Yes, they were identified as members of the Lynch mob. Appellant was identified as a member of the Lynch mob going back to 2009. So he was well into the gang mentality, one would suppose.
I missed that.
Brown had spent a lot of time with Appellant, even that evening. He was the one who went to the concert with Appellant. One, the jury could safely presume that, having told other people of his intent to kill, that Appellant shared that with CJ as well. After the crime, they fled. They didn't seek any medical attention for the victim. They tried to hide out. Appellant even sent text messages looking for a place to hide out and included Brown specifically in it, one of the persons that he text messaged to say, hey, I need a place to hang out. And he said, well, only you can come. He said, no, Brown's got to come with me. All those, both before and after, the state would maintain, go to support the jury's finding that there was a mutual agreement and an intent to kill.
If there's an agreement, those, then that both, dumps both us apart. Into the conspiracy statute.
I beg your pardon?
If we're talking about an agreement and we, I mean, you can't separate 702B as you interpret it from the conspiracy statute, which is a lower range of punishment. And Brodsky is the case that y'all relied on the fact that there was a difference between the conspiracy statute and 702B, so you could prosecute Brodsky again. So, I mean, trying to dump this into a conspiracy, I think, is really slippery.
The state alleged both 702A and 702B. 702A would be aid, solicit, encourage, all
right,
you know,
and
the,
also
the laundry list.
But it includes the flight or the aftermath of the offense. If you aid somebody in afterwards, well, in escaping from the crime. Makes you a party too, doesn't it?
But you could. The state would maintain that you could. The court could infer some sort of agreement prior to that to any aid that he gave after.
But
recognizing that he's guilty as a party, he would help to aid, help him to get away.
You don't need an agreement. All you need is his acts, right?
You don't need a specific agreement, no. Just aid, encourage, solicit,
right.
That sort of thing.
Right.
So correct,
it's,
yes.
Yeah.
To that extent, very
and
much so.
So.
You do not need a specific agreement. I'm not suggesting.
Yeah.
If I suggested that we were putting on or needed to put on evidence of an agreement, I beg the court's pardon. All we needed to prove was either 702A or 702B. I would point out, even in the charge as to the 702B, it was aggravated assault or organized criminal activity. So even if you were to knock it out, although the state maintains you don't, that's not how it's analyzed, then you would be okay. Also, I want to specifically for a moment look at the testimony of Trigg. The defense claims that Trigg said that it was an accident. The state maintains that he said just the opposite. And if you would beg, if I beg the court's indulgence.
Sure, what page?
I'm trying to find it right now, Your Honor.
2829.
No, in the record.
In the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. All right, page, volume 5, page 234.
Yeah.
Okay.
And do you understand in the process of, this is on cross-examination, and do you understand in the process of fighting over the gun, when it goes off, that's when it's Jeremy, who's the victim, that got shot? Yes, he got answer. Yes, he got shot when it went off. Question, and wouldn't you agree with me that in wrestling over the gun that anything could have happened as far as what made it actually go off? Answer, no, he made it go off, referring to Brown. So contrary to the appellant's argument that it was an accident, and there's only evidence it's an accident, the record does contain evidence that at least one of the eyewitnesses specifically stated he believed that it was intentional. The other witness, by the way, also indicated that she believed that it was intentional as well. She didn't see the specific shot, but she said, I saw them wrestling with the gun. I looked away to pull him back, to pull appellant back with the stick. When I heard the gun go off, when I turned, I saw him standing over with a gun. There is also evidence that Trigg, too, testified that he saw a Brown standing over him with the gun, pointing it at him, hesitating as to whether, they didn't say hesitating whether a pilot shoot again, but anyway, standing over him, poised over him, until a woman from the car pulled him back and said, let's go. So there is sufficient evidence, more than sufficient evidence, the state would maintain, to show intent both on Brown's part and actions on appellant's part that would make him guilty as a party. There is additional evidence that's set out in the brief, the state's brief, but those are the main points of dispute as to the facts that the state would put forward at this juncture. Turning to the submission of the sudden passion charge, as the state has already, as I've already suggested, he wasn't entitled to it. They started the fight. And the case law is very clear. You can't rely on sudden passion. You can't rely on self-defense if you're the one who started, you're the one who precipitated the fight. Moreover, he pulled a gun. There's no evidence that he was in such, even if you assume that they were, he was somehow entitled to sudden passion, he wasn't in this instance because there's no evidence of that he was acting under any sort of terror or fright to the extent that it would somehow obviate it would lower his culpability for the offense. That's laid out in the state's brief as well. It's been a long day for y'all, and unless you have any questions, the state will move for an affirmance.
Lisa?
One thing I want to point out is the testimony that he just read from Trigg was on cross-examination. On direct examination is where he specifically states, and I didn't, and if I said this, I apologize to the court. He never said the words accident. I said the words accident because what he says is they were wrestling over the gun and the gun just went off. And during his direct testimony, he says that quite a few times that the gun went off. And I know the prosecutor wanted to try to get him to say that he meant to shoot him. He tried to shoot him. He was trying to kill him. But Mr. Trigg was being very honest as far as the events that occurred, and the gun just went off during the course of them wrestling over the gun. The other thing I'd like to point out is that, you know, we bring up this lynch mob. The state was allowed to introduce a lot of evidence concerning gang conduct, and there was absolutely no evidence that this particular event had anything to do with any type of gang conduct. They weren't yelling lynch mob. There was not a threat mob on the text messages. This was a fight over the Super Bowl. But yet they were allowed to introduce all of this, and it's extensive, and it's very prejudicial. And I would have been objecting my rear end off, but in this particular instance, because they had the engaging in organized crime count that the jury found not guilty on, that's why they were allowed to introduce all of that highly prejudicial evidence. And it is my opinion because of that, and it's my argument to this court, is that's why a jury could end up finding somebody guilty even in light of insufficient evidence to prove an intent to shoot somebody with a gun by a co-conspirator or a co-defendant. My client's one removed. There's no evidence that my client knew CJ had a gun. My client didn't hand him the gun and say, go do this. Hey, for backup, keep this gun. There's nothing in the record that reflects that my client was aware that CJ had a gun. Obviously, he did. Obviously, he overacted, or he felt like he was in fear for his life once they got into this little fist fight that clearly was the intent when they went there. We're going to hash it out, or somebody's going to fall, and it's squashed. And the victim fully agreed to participate in those events.
In the text messages before the fight,
yes.
What did appellant say he was going to do to these people, to this guy that wouldn't pay the bill?
And correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding or my memory is there was threats to kill a long time ago, prior to this hashing up of this event. Over the Super Bowl, he had said on a couple of text messages, I'm going to smoke him or some bad language, you know, stuff. I'm going to kill the MF or something like that.
And smoke.
But smoke him
we
means?
We know means
murder.
To
yes.
Shoot him, right?
Right. But those events were separate. If you'll just read it, and I know it's hard to look past the actual words, but those text messages occurred way previous to this agreement to get together.
Okay.
Those were threats to try to get paid. And then it all kind of died down. Nothing was going on for a while. And then they had this conversation where they both agreed they're just going to get together and fist it out, fisticuffs it out. I do take serious issue with an argument. I think it's scary and a slippery slope to say that if you and I go, say we go out somewhere and you and I end up participating in a fist fight together. Somebody, you know, so you decide you don't like this girl, you hit her, and I join in the fight. I could fully participate in a fist fight and want to hit somebody and maybe want to knock them down on the ground. I don't like them or whatever reason. They didn't pay me my bet. But I don't think that that automatically means that I am down for you pulling a gun out of your waistband and shooting that girl. And I think that that is dangerous territory. I don't think it's what the law anticipates. There has to be an intent to kill, an intentional or knowingly killing, or an intent to cause serious bodily injury to shoot with a firearm on the actor's part.
My specific question, which obviously wasn't clear, really went to going to get a different weapon that was capable of causing death. Was that some indication or some evidence from which a jury could conclude an intent to cause the death? Because the board with the nails in it is capable of.
Right. If you're going to talk about my intent as the Edwards or Trey's intent to cause the death by grabbing the board,
mm-hmm.
that still doesn't accrue to CJ's intent.
Okay.
With a gun accidentally going off.
Okay.
In my opinion, and I think that's in the law as well, but that's my rendition of it.
Ms. Mullen, the text that you're talking about, there was some evidence, I mean, there's some discussion of that there was as many as 15 phone calls within minutes that came to Mr. Thomas, and texts that were 5 minutes before the people got to the 7-Eleven. That was the location for the fight. My bail money at CJ, Kevin Brown's house in a drawer. And then a minute later, I'm going to find a shoot him, slang for I'm going to shoot him. That's right before they get to the 7-Eleven.
That's to the girlfriend. Those text messages are
yes,
to
ma'am.
The girlfriend. Yes, not a threat to kill the victim, but to the girlfriend.
Well,
yes.
He's telling her what he's planning to do as I read these texts.
Fixing to go shoot him.
I still don't think that accrues to the intent of CJ. I still don't think he had a gun to kill him. There's no evidence he had knowledge that CJ actually had a gun. I think he's bragging to his girlfriend about he's going to get his money back because the guys made him look bad by not paying the debt. But I don't think that accrues to the events that occurred when they start wrestling over the gun and the gun goes off.
I have trouble with the volume and numbers of communications that appear to at least evidence a state of mind of Mr. Washington before and after the shooting that killed Mr. Thomas.
I totally understand that. I totally understand that. I just, you know, once again, I think that if he had actually had the gun and pulled the trigger, I think that infers to his intent. But I think this is once removed, and from the testimony in this case, the trigger was not supposed to go off. The gun wasn't supposed to be used.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Any other questions?
No.
Okay, thanks, Lisa. We appreciate you coming here today, and your case is submitted, and you're the last case, so this court will be adjourned.